Welcome to Comms Coach, the podcast that delves deep into the world of training and quality assurance for 911. Your host, Lori Henriksen, is a veteran in the field with more than 30 years' experience as a dispatcher, trainer, and high school teacher who started one of the country's first 911 dispatch programs for high school students in Las Vegas, Nevada. In each episode, a lineup of expert guests dive into the critical aspects of emergency communications training, quality assurance, and improvement. This is Comms Coach, building the strength behind every call.
I'd like to thank everyone for listening today and welcome you to the first of many podcasts designed to offer insight into the challenges and demands of 911 dispatch centers and discuss strategies that we can implement to ensure that we're serving our communities and responders in the best way possible. This begins with well-trained dispatchers who are confident in their skills and enjoy what they do. I'd like to now introduce you to my good friend and fire communications chief, Wendy Lottman. Wendy has spent several years in the dispatch field and has vast knowledge and expertise in call taking and dispatching operations and in supervision. Wendy, can you please give us a brief description of your background in emergency telecommunications?
Sure. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I started my career many years ago, I think as did you. And I was hired with the Bureau of Emergency Communications in Portland, Oregon in 1997. So I've been doing this a long time. I was hired as a dispatch trainee and went in. They did fire, EMS, and police. So I was trained in all of those disciplines. I was a call taker, a dispatcher. I became a coach and a trainer. I was a frontline supervisor. I was the training supervisor for a while. And then I actually left after 16 and a half years from there. I was offered a position in management with actually public transportation. And I went,
oh, wow, that's assistant. Different.
Yeah, very different, but the same. It was interesting because I was offered the position as assistant manager of operations command center and then became the manager. They created a manager position for me there. And it was a lot of the same issues. They basically were dispatching buses and trains, the rail controllers, but the issues were very, very similar to working in an ECC and the employees that I'd worked with before. The training and hiring issues and things there were very, very similar. And then 5 years ago, I was offered the position to come and manage the 911 center here at Las Vegas, Portland Fire and Rescue. Portland Fire and Rescue. See, I go back. Sometimes I'm like Portland Fire and Rescue. It's Las Vegas Fire and Rescue, but it was also Portland Fire and Rescue. I get tongue-tied. So 5 years ago, I came and took a position in Las Vegas, that my position as the fire communications chief oversees the 911 center. We're secondary PSAP, here in Las Vegas for fire and EMS. The police, as you know, are dispatched from Metro, dispatch. And they're a lot bigger than us because police, you know, the police calls are about three times as much as fire and EMS in general. And that's true here, too. But we're still a pretty large center, even just doing fire and EMS. And so, like I said, I've been here for 5 years and we're rolling right along and trying to make improvements in our center and keep up with technology.
And that's actually where I met you through is your career here at City of Las Vegas, which I absolutely love your department. So many people that I've met there have been amazing. And a lot of the former dispatch students that I've had are now working there and doing great jobs. So
absolutely. We love hiring the new recruits that come from your training program. You know, I know you spent a lot of years developing and teaching that too. So, So then that's a really unique partnership that you just don't see in a lot of places. So we love seeing those former students come through and apply and come and work for us. I think we're up to eight now. I think we have eight.
Oh my gosh.
Former dispatcher. Yeah. Of your former students.
That's awesome.
So, yeah.
That's awesome. And for the most part, they've done very well. So
yeah.
That brings us to my next question is, what do you consider the essential characteristics of a successful dispatcher?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny because I remember when I was hired, you know, like I said, I was over 25 years ago. Even then, people were saying only 2% of the people can do this job. And I think that that was a way to kind of boost people of like, you have really good skills and a very unique skill set. But I also think that's a little limiting in the mindset of who could be a good, you know, who can be a good dispatcher. I think that previously the mindset was you had to be like a real A-type controlling personality and be super directive and you know, come in. But nobody wants to work in a room full of A-type personalities that are all,
no.
all trying to control the situation, right?
That's part of the problem.
You're right. So, and so I think, you know, as we've adapted and grown and the industry has changed and call volume has increased and resources have been depleted over time for various things, I think the most successful dispatchers do have some similar characteristics. Those revolve around resiliency and adaptability. They're people who are self-motivated and self-managing. They're people who take initiative to, you know, to learn something new and don't just sit in their previous knowledge, you know, that are motivated. So, you know, when we look at people who come in and train well and are successful, especially now and in current times, you know, they're the people that are open-minded, that have a customer service focus, that can have self-discipline and are self-motivated, but have that kind of adaptability and you know, an initiative to continue to learn and better themselves as well.
Right. And that adaptability is probably really important now with the attrition rate we've had and people working so much overtime and all of the many facets of dispatch now with the shifts and all that. So if they're willing and able to change and come in on their day off and all that, that's big.
Yeah, absolutely. It's difficult, you know, and it's not an easy job. And so to have that resiliency and adaptability, I just think is so important. And you can't write a rule for everything either. So, you know, that ability to adapt and understand the point of something, but not just the black and white rule of law, because every situation that you get might not have a specific rule for it, right? So you have to be kind of creative and resilient and be able to adapt the rules that you've learned to new situations, because they get thrown into, you know, awkward and weird scenarios all the time when they're talking to people on the phone. I mean, people don't just call and answer the questions politely and move on. So, you know, so that adaptability plays out in so many different ways and how they handle the calls and how they handle their coworkers and the culture of the room and the business and how they handle their, you know, their own life and their schedule. I mean, it just applies to kind of everything, every aspect of being a dispatcher.
Totally. Well, what importance do you think should be placed on the skill of effective communication?
Communication is just so important in everything. I mean, communication is important in every aspect of your life. when it comes to being a dispatcher, you know, that ability to communicate with people and connect with people is just so important. If you have the ability to connect with somebody on the phone, even when they're in crisis, and make them feel supported and make them know that they're being heard, it makes the call usually go so much smoother. You know, they're more willing to answer your questions. You literally have like this trust built, you know, with somebody possibly within 15 seconds, and they're calmer and they're answering your questions versus people who maybe take a more direct approach and come across and they kind of get in more of a combative type of, you know, conversation with their caller. And I do people who can adapt their tone and their, even the cadence and all of those things to meet the need of the person that they're talking to. Like when I see people do that and they're not just, they don't just sound the same on every single call because they're listening to who their caller is that's calling into them and adapting to that and controlling that call in a professional and, you know, kind and compassionate way. It's amazing. I mean, that's the best call to listen to, right? And then to see them do that and not be the same on every call and just and have that effective communication. There are just some people that have it and there's some people have to learn it, you know, but it's, again, that just makes your job easier in so many ways, not only on the call, but with your supervisors, with your coworkers. And I think effective communication skills are just key. That's just if you can master effective communication, you're going to be successful. You know, regardless of which area you want to go into, or if you want to promote, or if you want to be a call taker, a dispatcher, or whatever. I just think that it's just so important.
That's true. And like you said, it's important to have effective communication with the outside and our responders, but everyone always forgets about the importance of communication inside the comm center. And again, that Absolutely. Can make or break a comm center. So
absolutely.
So with that being said, what about the psychological resilience that's needed?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a concept that, critical incident stress and peer support and things like that. Those concepts have been around for, you know, for quite a while now. They're not really new anymore. They were pretty new when I started. But this focus on resiliency is, as I think, like I said, an even more important area to kind of pursue. In Portland, when I was up there, there was a doctor at the university who wrote a book, and it's called The Resiliency Advantage. And kind of the point of the book was, why are some people faced with horrific situations and come out even better and more positive? And some people are faced with similar situations and are basically kind of destroyed and bitter and angry for the rest of their lives. And it kind of questions, like, you know, what did these people possess or have that these others maybe didn't in a similar situation? And why do some people rise and some people sort of sink, you know, and fall? And having gone through a pretty long career where I've had areas of burnout and different things like that, I don't think there's one magic bullet that solves everybody's issue for, you know, for making them feel or be more resilient. But I think that part of it comes down to a choice. I know for me personally, I feel like I'm too lazy to be angry and in a bad mood for too long. Because it drains me. It takes a lot out of me.
True. I get it.
You know what I mean? I'm like, I would rather be happier and go to work and be happy. So that doesn't mean that bad things don't happen. And it doesn't mean that you forget about bad things that have happened. But how quickly can you bounce back from, you know, from something that's negative? And what are the tools that you use to do that? In my life, I've used different tools. At one point in time, I became a CASA volunteer because I kind of felt like I was at a point in my career where I was like, is what I'm doing making a difference? Does it matter? I don't really see the results of it. I didn't really feel like I was making an impact. So right. I became a CASA volunteer, which is court appointed special advocate and assigned a case, for foster kids. And you go in and basically assess their needs, kind of do an independent assessment and write reports to the court on like what these kids really need during their time in foster care and what you think is in the best interest of, you know, of these children. And I did that for over 4 years, and that was kind of my way of having a more obvious and instant feedback of impact and change that I didn't really feel like I was getting, at the job at the time.
That's awesome.
You talked about overtime. Yeah. At one point, I mean, I was one of those people that I loved going on trips and buying things and spending money. So I loved working overtime. And I didn't realize the impact of that overtime until like I was in a good mood until I walked through the door, and then I was in a bad mood every day. And it took me time to be like, wait a minute, this is of my doing. Like, why am I doing this? And I just made a deal with myself that I would work my mandatory overtime, obviously, because I had to, but I did not sign up for voluntary overtime for 6 months. Wow. And actually took my weekends and found other things to do and connected myself to the world in other ways, because I was just spending way too much time, you know, way too much time at work.
And you need to do that. Yeah,
absolutely. And so I think resiliency, you know, I think that's a key for a lot of it. It's very easy to become insulated because of the hours and the shifts and the things, and you kind of become like insulated and isolated from what else is going on in the world, and that there's so many other things. So for me, I always try and encourage people to do things outside of the work realm, you know, connect to classes or travel or, you know, whatever it is, a sport or a hobby or something that, that's maybe non-work related, you know. Join a book club where nobody that in that book club works with you. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
You know, so
especially, yes.
Exactly. I just think that there's so many ways for people to engage and help build their resilience, because I think the more you connect to the world outside of yourself and your circle, I personally think that helps build, you know, build your resilience as well. But certainly there's plenty of tools. And I mean, almost everybody has some form of EAP or peer support or counseling or something through their insurance that, you know, if they need to have somebody to talk to, if they need to, you know, have some referrals, or, you know, or maybe, even have medications prescribed because they're having difficulty sleeping, or they're, you know, having reactions to certain type of calls. You know, I think it's important to use those resources, you know, as well. And all of those things play into, you know, how resilient you are based and when you're faced with certain things at work.
Right. And you and I both know when we first started, all of this stuff was a no-no. You just did your job and that was it. And I think that's why there was so much burnout. Right now, employees have so much access, and just from working with the newer generation now, I think they're more willing and able to go and see a therapist and get the help that they need. So
Absolutely. It's so important, yeah, to take care of yourself and figure out what works for you. Because it's like right. I said, it's not one size fits all. So you got to figure out what works for you and what makes you feel better about yourself and the world around you.
Right. Well, and going back to your CASA, that's awesome, because, you know, on the phones and all that, you listen to people's problems and you try to deal with it on the phones. With CASA, you actually got to see the results and got to go out and really help. So in a different way.
Right.
So I think that's awesome.
Yeah. And it was amazing. That's awesome. I probably would have stayed a volunteer, but I actually became a supervisor and my shift changed and I had completely different days off. And so I kind of took a break, and then I became involved in other things and, you know, kind of never went back. But I was still involved. You know, like I said, I was involved with that one family for 4.5 years. When the very first one that I got assigned to, I was still, they were just finalizing all of their things when I decided to take a break about 4.5 years later. So I still think about them. I think the kids are like in their early 20s now. Like,
wow.
It was a long time ago.
Wow.
And I think about that sometimes, you know, like how old they are and what they're doing now. But yeah, it was definitely rewarding. And I, like I said, I kind of filled that space that I felt was missing at that moment in time with work.
Right. That void. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what strategies do you, or that can be used to identify some of the characteristics we've talked about during recruitment? Like, how do you find these people?
Yeah, it's hard, because I liken most of the recruitment processes to speed dating, where you know, you don't really have a lot of time with people. You know, I remember in Portland, we would do marathon interview sessions where, you know, we'd interview 55 to 65 people in 3 or 4 days. And, you know, yeah. And so like by day three, you barely remember the people that you talked to on day one,
right?
You know, and sometimes by the end of day three, you barely remember the people you talked to at the beginning of day three. So it's like, it's
right.
You're fried. So you're just getting an impression of somebody. You don't really know them. And so I think that when, you know, we talk about designing questions to highlight the characteristics that you're going for, you know, so if, like in our process, we talked about, you know, we're looking for people who have good customer service, who are adaptable and things like that. So, you know, so the questions that we asked are designed to kind of get at those types of answers. We tried to put some of those questions in like the supplemental process so that they would write the answers rather than having to do that initial interview, you know, and do like 3 or 4 days worth of interviews. But the answers that people put in writing were not as complete as what they would say in person. Like they were even shorter than what we would get out of somebody in person. So this last time we put them in as a video interview. So they still got the supplemental questions, but they had to answer those questions in a video interview. And let me tell you, you get so much more out of that by understanding who this person is, by where they place themselves, what they wear, where are they when they're doing this interview, what's going on in the background. Are they Are they taking it seriously, like an interview, and still like dressed up, or are they super casual in like a t-shirt, or, you know what I mean? Like things like,
right.
Did they make their bed in the background? You know, there's all kinds of things.
Are there cats jumping around?
Right. That you glean as, you know, that you glean from like their experience and kind of who they are. And it's still a snapshot, right. But that was so much better than just having them write the answers to the questions or try and, you know, interview a massive amount of people. Because we were able to review over 100 video interviews in 2.5 days.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And that's a good idea too, because then you also get to see their communication skills, because right. It's a lot different than writing an answer versus having to speak.
Right. So I think it's the way that you design the questions. I think that, you know, when I laugh, because when I remember when I was interviewed, the skills test was, here's a book, find this phone number, repeat it back, you know, and right. There was like a little pegboard that had like certain circles and colors, and you had to like follow the instructions of putting like the round circle on the blue peg and the triangle on the red peg or whatever, you know. And I just and I kind of laughed, because I get that it was just a follow instructions and skills, like decision making memory type of type of practical test,
right?
But we're so far advanced from that these days, I think, that those types of skill tests come out in either some kind of online test, a data entry or typing test. You know, we use Critical, which kind of does a little bit of everything. It tests decision making and memory recall, reading comprehension, typing, all that, you know. So they do have a test like, you know, like that in our process as well. Right. 'Cause you want to know that they have some skill in that area for sure. But yeah, it's really the questions that you design. I mean, if you know, you don't get a lot of really good answers out of, you know, what are your top three strengths and what are your top, you know, if you were a tree, right. What kind of tree would you be? You know, like kind of you don't really get at the skills that you're looking for. So you really have to design your questions towards the traits that you're evaluating or saying, you know, you want to try and hire, you know, in larger quantities. So I think there's other things we could do in recruitment, but I think in the hiring process, I think that you get the big brush strokes of those characteristics in the hiring process. If you target them, and then you really learn those when they're in training and whether or not, you know, and whether or not those are really good skills that they have, and are truly internalized, or, you know, is that just kind of a surface thing?
So I liked what you said about the, like the oral board type questions of like, what are your weaknesses? What are your strengths? I just know when I was preparing my students for their mock interviews at the end of the year, everybody says the same thing. You always get that awkward person that says something strange, or maybe they say, my weakness is I can't type, or my weakness is I don't like to talk to people. That's the one that you're going to check mark off. But pretty much everyone always says the same thing that they think you want to hear. So.
Right. We used to ask a question that was like, if we called your previous supervisor right now, what would they say about your attendance and reliability? Nobody said they would say I was horrible. Like every single person said, oh, they would say it was great. But the people who would pause just a little bit and be like, well, I think they would say, and we're like, okay, no, they're definitely not.
Please don't call them. Right.
You know,
here's another number instead.
Right. But I'm like, but most people are going to say what they know the answer should be geared towards, even if it's a little bit of a stretch, you know? So it's like asking some of those questions. That's what we found. We're like, you, if you're getting the same answer from every applicant, it's not a valuable question.
True.
You know,
that's true. Right. So let's talk about, where can potential candidates for these positions receive pre-employment training, or what can people do to prepare? Because I know that's a question that's always asked.
Mm-hmm. Well, and like I said, in the last few years, we've focused on that customer service aspect because there's so much, even in school, there's so much that's done online or has been done online. We want to know that people can talk face-to-face. We want to know that people have had either forward-facing or direct customer-facing type of experience. So we require customer service experience. And that could be almost any type of customer-facing job. That could be working at a drive-through, at a coffee shop. You know, that could be working in a call center. We've had people that have applied that were like debt collectors and had to talk to people on the phone about their debt. We're like, okay, we know they've talked to angry people, right?
Exactly.
You know? So we want to know that you can talk to different types of people. So having those types of jobs is very helpful and beneficial. Most community colleges or, you know, other schools in the area, have, like you said, have some kind of classes on typing skills and communication classes and things like that, that I think are extremely helpful. Again, these days, you know, when we were in school, they had typing class where you were on typewriters.
Right. That's how I tested for the department in the beginning was my typing test was actually on a typewriter.
Yeah. Like on a typewriter. And now, I mean, kids grow up on phones and computers and laptops and things like that. So they kind of have those skills, but actually being able to do data entry and have accuracy and all that, you know, that's still something that people can take classes and work on and practice, or even do online courses for that type of stuff. I know we talked about geography. I mean, especially if you're going into an area that you don't know. Again, we didn't have computerized maps when I started. So when I was trained, they made us memorize the 100 blocks and know all the directions of all the streets and, you know, in the area. But we rely on, you know, mapping and computers to do a lot of that for us now, but it's still good skills to have, understanding how to read a map, being familiar with the area, understanding where the freeways go and maybe what they're called, because a lot of freeways have nicknames. And when people call in, they don't say, you know, the actual directional of that freeway, how you can enter it in a CAD system. They say the nickname, or, you know, in the Portland area, it was the Sunset or the Banfield. Well, those are both I-84, but it depended on what side of town you were on. Yeah. So it was just, like I said, it just depends on, the focus, how familiar you are with the area, but knowing where hospitals are and police stations and fire stations and major landmarks in the area, that's always stuff that you can go and do, you know, drive around and have an understanding of your area. It was always easier for somebody to be like, I'm at this intersection by, you know, the Jack in the Box, and you'd be able to picture that in your head and go, oh, across the street is the, you know, the Walgreens that they're talking about, kind of thing. So, so there's a lot of things that people can do to just, better their area awareness and work on those types of skills.
I know that was the thing that when I first started sending students to apply for your department, was the feedback that I was given is, hey, these kids don't know map work. They don't know landmarks at all. So that's when I took a step back and started teaching that a lot more. But I have found that with the newer generation, they do not know how to read. I shouldn't say everyone, but the vast majority of my students have never really held a paper map. So teaching those map skills. And then again, wherever they are, is just driving around and knowing the landmarks.
Mm-hmm. And I think part of it too, is we forget that sometimes technology fails us. You know, we can have power outages and we can have glitches in technology where those resources are suddenly not available to us. And if you don't have a backup plan, if you don't have the knowledge and ability, you know, to be able to kind of look at a wall map and figure out what needs to happen or where somebody is, you know, that's always a valuable skill.
True. And then I know I've gotten quite a few people that have emailed me as well, like, how can I prepare for police or for the fire department here? And, you know, if they're younger, then obviously a vocational program in a high school like we have, and some others are fortunate to have across the United States. And there are quite a few community colleges that are offering certifications now too, or courses, like you said, in communications and some dispatch classes. But yeah, all the things that you've said have been like spot on. So is when selecting candidates for this job, how would you describe that one superstar applicant? So if you could just describe the most ultimate person, what would their characteristics be?
Yeah, it's funny. In every, I've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people, I'm not going to lie. And in every interview process that I've been to, regardless of what type of job, there's always like those one or two candidates where you're like, oh, they're the superstars, right? And then other people are like, yeah, they were good, but I don't know, or you have reservations. And I think part of it has to do with authenticity, because everybody's nervous going into a job interview. And so some people, you know, that that manifests in different ways. So people always think it's about being confident and being super direct, but sometimes that comes across as super, super arrogant and not being able to self-reflect or self-managing. Like I was saying before, like that's another element. So I think it's the people who come in and do have a certain level of confidence to the point where they exude that they know who they are and they know what their skills are. They don't oversell or undersell themselves. But they come in and they listen to the question, they answer the question that was actually asked. They clearly understand the question, answer the question that was asked, and do it in a way that's very authentic and truthful. You can tell when people are hedging, or you can tell when people are trying to avoid bringing up a certain topic, because sometimes we'll ask questions about like conflict or about feedback, you know, tell us about a time when you received negative feedback or something like that. And people are like, I've never received negative feedback. I'm like, come on, really? Never? You know what I mean? That's just hard to believe. Like, you know, I'm like, okay, so if you can't be honest about that, what are you also not being honest about? So I think the people that come in and recognize that, that we're human, we don't expect them to be perfect. We want them to be truthful and honest and with their answers, and that can actually relate their skills to what they're going to be facing in this job. So, you know, we could have kids or even young adults come in that don't have a ton of job experience, and maybe they were a barista, or, you know, they worked in a spa, or they did something. But when they recognize these are the skills that I gained in those types of jobs and how I'm going to apply those to this job, we're like, yeah, that's who we want. We want that person who's like, yeah, I've dealt with difficult people, and this is how I've met that challenge. And you know that they're at least thinking about how those skills relate to the new job, because we don't expect everybody to come in and know about 911 and know the job already. But if they know themselves and they know they do have an understanding of their strengths and weaknesses, you know, it's okay to come in and say, I know I need to work on this. That like, we still are like, that's a great answer, because you have the ability to self-assess and guide yourself to like, okay, this is an area that I can work on, without having to be told this is an area that you can work on. And we key into those things because those people are trainable. Those people are going to follow the rules, and those people are going to, you know, are going to be able to be successful in the program. So I think it truly boils down to authenticity and being very honest and straightforward in their answers. And like I said, those who have good customer service skills and can demonstrate that, good communication skills and can demonstrate that, and have that resiliency and self-assessment ability, those are the star candidates, like, you know, hands down. They don't all have to have the perfect answer, but when you know that they're telling it truthfully and like from the heart, they're, you know, they tend to be the ones that shine. We're like, yeah, that's who we want.
That's true. That coachable, teachable type person.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Absolutely.
All right. So we know that dispatch training varies throughout the U.S. What do you feel are the benefits to running a structured training program?
I think it's super important. I'm still surprised that industry-wide we don't have a national standard. I know that it's been a topic in a lot of the professional organizations for a while. But, you know, it benefits and protects everybody. It's better for the public and the people calling in. It's better for the employees. It's better for the organizations. You know, I've been to places where they hire people and they don't have any classroom training and they go straight to on the job. And I know smaller agencies, you know, versus larger agencies, things are different, but I just can't fathom that. Like, how do you just throw somebody into the fire? You know?
No.
So I think that, you know, when I've seen states that have at least a basic certification program, or have their, you know, like 911 funding and stuff run by the state that provides training and or provides standards. It, even though a lot of it is pretty basic, I think the benefit to the public is that you know that you are going to get at least a certain level of service, right? That everybody has a certain level of knowledge and a certain level of expertise. I think what we forget sometimes is that, you know, we have a monopoly in this business in 911. People can't choose who to call for 911, you know? So it's like they get who they get, and you hope that who you're calling knows what they're doing. And so the benefit for the public is that feeling of that bit of security and safety net of knowing that people are trained and have some kind of standard and have met some kind of industry standard. You know, if you have a more structured training program that that meets, you know, some of the industry guidelines that are out there. I also think it helps the employee. They know what the expectation is. They know, you know, what skills they need to have, what knowledge they need to have. And it provides them some stability in their job as well. And then right. I just think, like, from a liability standpoint, from an agency standpoint, having been in supervisory and management roles, you know, you know full well, if it's not in writing, it didn't happen. And, you know, you don't want that one time, you know, people are like, oh, well, do agencies really, really get sued? Yeah, they do. And they cities get sued all the time. And even though sometimes we might not ever specifically hear about it in our careers, it happens. And I know that from my current role, that sometimes those lawsuits and things pop up and it's years later that, you know, they're talking about an incident that happened in like 2018 or 2020. And you don't, if you don't have records of how you train people and what your policies were and, you know, and all that kind of stuff, it's really hard to defend that somebody did something the right way or that they actually followed your policy if you can't produce your policy and your training records. And so, having that structured training program, I just think is super important. We don't have a state coordinator in Nevada. So having come from Oregon where there is a standards, you know, there is a basic certification. They have a couple of different certification levels that you can get as a telecommunicator in public safety. But at least having that basic knowledge, knowing everybody has taken these types of classes and have gotten the basics and understand the system and like the basic requirements, that just sets you all on a more even playing field. I think for states that have much more structured, I have a lot of friends that work in Massachusetts and, you know, they have funding and they provide statewide training. And those type of states are going to be much more well equipped to also help each other out. If they're trained on and have more standards that are similar from agency to agency, you're more likely to be able to help out your neighboring agency if something happens because you're working off the same, you know, basically out of the same playbook, even if your systems are a little bit different or not. You know, I've been in the business a long time. Could I take a 911 call in another agency and write it down on paper? Sure. Could I figure out their, you know, their particular CAD system? If they had a set of questions, can I follow a set of questions? Sure. But if they don't have those things and they don't have that structure, I mean, I could go and take a call, but I have no idea if I'm meeting any of their policies and guidelines, you know?
Right.
So I just think it's so important on so many levels. And I really think our trainers are the unsung heroes in so many ways. In so many ways. I think that having a structured training program and putting the time and effort into putting those things in writing and making sure that you have that documentation is just so important. I've seen it save us. I mean, I've literally seen it save us when we've gotten notices of lawsuits and like, nope, they followed the policy. Here it is. This is how they were trained. They did exactly what they were trained. And the attorneys are like, yep, we support you and we're going to fight it, you know?
Right. And it really protects the agency and it protects the person and it protects them in a different way too, because if you have the training and you have the background and then you build that confidence. And if you're confident in what you're saying, and obviously, you know, that the outcome of every call is not always positive and great. People right. get hurt, people die. And when you take that type of call, if you have the confidence to know that you are well-trained and you did what you could do and you said the right things, then it's easier for you to get through it and get through to the next call and get through with your day.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So the last question I have are, what are the challenges though of running a training program?
Yeah, there are many. I think, you know, I was thinking about this question earlier, and I think that one of the main things is that the people that have to do the training and run training programs mm-hmm. are usually not the bigger decision makers of the department.
Right.
And they tend to have a lot of things thrown at them. And so when we talk about adaptability and resiliency, training programs need to be so adaptable and so resilient because frequently you're given, like we talk about equipment, like the equipment stops working. Okay. Well, you've still got to teach this topic. What do you do when the equipment doesn't work? You come in and suddenly the CAD doesn't work. That just happened to us this week. You know, like all of a sudden the training CAD didn't work. And it's like, okay, well, they're dispatch trainees. What are you going to do without the training CAD? So you have to pivot right. sometimes daily. You don't always have control over how many people are in your class, what technology you have available to you. So I think that some of the challenges are not only actually putting things in writing and not just doing things because, well, that's the way we've always done it. And actually, you know, putting some training into writing, making sure that you're trying to meet some of those best practices and include some of that information in training for everybody, but trying to make sure your technology is updated. Do you have adequate space? I'll give you an example for us, for our agency, you know, we have a training room that basically has five desks and one training, actual live training console that we can put in the training mode. And mm-hmm. So if you're training five people, even if you're training six people, we trained seven people and they were like, okay, that's doable. This last time we were told we were hiring 12 people. So 12 people can't fit in that room.
Right.
So then you have to suddenly be like, okay, what are we going to do and how are we going to do this and still give them the most effective training, but with that mm-hmm. many people in, without more equipment, you know, without more
right.
trainers,
right.
you know, so yeah, but when I was in Portland and I was the training supervisor, you know, I kind of oversaw everything as the training supervisor. I wasn't the primary instructor. But that was it too. It's like we got to have a coach pulled for the class. And that coach would be basically that academy's main instructor and like their kind of guide, right? Mm-hmm. But we were constantly having to adapt to whatever was happening that day, or suddenly a speaker who's supposed to come and do something doesn't show up, or you know. So it's like I just think that the topic itself is so dense to try and train everything that you need to know to be a good call taker, and then also to be a mm-hmm. good dispatcher. It's labor intensive, and it like has to be a labor of love because you can't do it for the money.
Right.
As you well know, Lori.
Right. Yeah.
That can't be your motivation, but it's also a lot of stress. I think people assume that, oh, you're going and working in the training gig and like, that's an easy gig. And now you don't have to take 911 calls anymore. So it's easier. But it's not, because I mean, you literally have people's careers in your hands. You're trying mm-hmm. to make people successful. You want them to come out with the traits that you want for your coworkers and, you know, and the next generation of call takers and dispatchers. It's a massive amount of responsibility. And like mm-hmm. I said, I think that they're very underappreciated and underrecognized and have to work around some of the craziest, you know, circumstances and adapt to all these different changes and everything thrown at them. So, I mean, I think that that's really the big thing. Even if you've built a training program that you think is great and you're like, I'm going to run this training program this way every single time, you're not,
no,
you know,
no,
you're just not.
No. Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And people forget that that part of a training program, like you had mentioned, is you need that classroom training, but then you also have to concentrate too on the floor training. They go hand in hand, and they're both very important. And documentation for both, like you said, liability.
Absolutely.
You need to be able to provide what you taught or what the student was taught.
Yeah, absolutely. As a training supervisor, when I was the training supervisor in Portland, you know, I said yes, we had an academy going on and there was a stuff, but part of why we brought that coach in to be like the primary person in those classes was because we have always had so many people in training. I had to review all the DORs every week. I had to, you know, do spreadsheets mm-hmm. on the scores and their progress and where they were at. We still had our in-service training, you know, in Las Vegas, we do quarterly training, you know, so you still have your current employees training. You have the new hire training in academies. You have to wrangle all these schedules with all these people, you know, so just like administratively, that's a lot of work, as well as the actual hands-on classroom work, as well as making sure your coaches are supported and prepared to be able to conduct the on-the-job training and do what they need to do. So yeah, it's definitely, you know, the heart and soul of any center is to make sure that you have, you know, a strong training program and you have, like I said, those resilient trainers and people that are willing to participate and do that. Because if we didn't, like, you know, like I said, we definitely, I know in Las Vegas, we wouldn't have as good of a crew as we have if we didn't have, you know, good training, a solid training program, and the support to try and make sure that we get the new hires and the coaches and stuff what they need to keep going.
Right. And we're very fortunate here, you guys and the different police departments that we have here, because, you know, fortunately, we're a bigger city. And so we do have the staff and the personnel to assist with this. And I know I've heard from a lot of the people at the different conferences that you and I have gone to, where they say, well, we can't really have a training program because, you know, we're a small center and we can, you know, we're barely surviving. But there are ways that people can get trained. There's a lot of different organizations and entities out there that provide the certifications. There's a lot of virtual certifications that an agency can use. But I think every agency out there needs to have that some type of mandatory training program, and then even continual training for their centers.
Absolutely. And every center that I've worked with, we've always had somebody come in either in leadership or like executive level or city council or, you know, whatever. Uh-huh. Come in and try and say, well, you need to hire people faster. You need to train people faster, you know, and there's a cost to that. And so, you know, I've always been one of those people who's tried to push back on that of like, you don't want to shortcut mm-hmm. their training. You want them to be able to stay. You don't want an immediate employee. You want a long-term employee. And if you don't invest in the processes and the training and to do all that, you're going to have a higher turnover rate. People are not going to succeed in their training ultimately if they're not given the tools and the structure and that foundation before they go out on the job training. And yeah, it's so important. And like I said, I feel like that's always an area where they think, oh, we'll just do it faster. We'll just hire more people. You know,
right.
just figure it out. And yeah, you do have to be creative. But I agree, there are a lot more entities out there now that provide other ways to train, and will do virtual classes and online classes and all that. You can find it. You can find it, and it doesn't always have to be at a huge cost either.
Right, and like you says, if you just take a little bit more time to invest in that employee and provide just a little bit more training, you're going to have that lifelong employee. But then. And I've said this to my students a lot. I said, you know, everyone blames the police or everyone blames the firefighter for that incident out there. But a lot of times it's not their fault. You know, I hate to say it, but a lot of times it's the dispatcher's fault because they didn't have the training or the knowledge to pass on to that responder. And then bad things happened. Mm-hmm. We are the first responder. So if we invest in us, I think we can make a lot of changes out there.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And there's definitely... foundations out there and people out there, like, as you know, when we go to conferences that speak about those types of incidents where it's not usually just one mistake, but it usually starts with a mistake at dispatch and then rolls mm-hmm. into a series of other mistakes or other things that are dropped or missed that that lead to, you know, some pretty horrific outcomes. So we certainly don't want anybody to come in and not have the training and have something like that be kind of a career ending incident where they either can't work anymore or, you know, they weren't prepared enough and end up having to leave for some, you know, some other reason. But yeah, you just have to prepare them and create that foundation. And I love it. And I'm just gonna do one quick plug is we actually had two dispatchers that were recognized by the Kyle Plush Foundation last week, which is the Answer the Call Foundation. And they work to reward dispatchers who go the extra mile and put in extra effort to find the person and resolve and help somebody. And we had two fairly new call takers who, actually spent almost 2 hours trying to find this woman who had called 911. And she realized about halfway through that maybe she didn't live in Las Vegas anymore, but she wasn't sure. Mm-hmm. And they ended up tracking her son's wife, and get their phone number. And she was in Bullhead City, Arizona. And,
oh, wow.
But they got, you know, they called and they got the people there to help her. And so, you know, that's part of it. It's like that's part of it too. If they didn't feel supported and trained, like they could do that and give that person that great service, then, you know, then maybe they wouldn't have found her. And not that that would have been a tragic outcome for that particular person, but, the fact that now we know that that person is okay because they spent the time to find, you know, to find her and make sure that she got her family and the resources over there, you know, that's a testament to their training and their support from, the other people in the room to make, you know, to make that happen and have a positive outcome.
That's so awesome. That totally makes me smile. That's awesome. That's really cool. Well, Wendy, thank you for sharing your insight into such an important discussion. I've respected you for so long. And while I'm mentioning that, I just want to thank you for your participation today.
No, thank you for inviting me. It's super. I'm honored to be your first guest, and I hope it all goes well. And I think all of these topics we could talk about for, you know, a lot longer each. So, right. So yeah, I'll be looking forward to hearing your next one. Thanks.
Awesome. Hopefully this has provided some great ideas and has offered some guidance to many of you. Future episodes will expand upon these and many more. If you have ideas for any topics that you would like to know more about, or if you are willing to share your expertise on future episodes, please email me at lori@comms-coach.com. That's lori@comms-coach.com. Thanks for listening and have a good one.